The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Should Dr. Fauci be prosecuted? How do we hold Fauci accountable? Or China? And Missouri gunslinger Mark McCloskey joins me to talk about his run for the Senate. This is the Dinesh D'Souza podcast.
America needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
How do we hold Dr. Fauci accountable? And China? It's time to go behind the mask, which is to say behind the Fauci mask, to figure out what this guy actually knew and also what this guy actually did. Now, the implications couldn't be more far-reaching, because if this is a virus, COVID-19, that was made in a lab in China, concocted, manufactured, and if this was done with U.S. knowledge and with U.S. help, with U.S. subsidy, direct or indirect, then think of what has really happened here. What has happened here is that our scientists and our government, in collusion with their government and their scientists, have unleashed a deadly virus on the world that has killed millions of people, that has killed in America alone more people than died in the Civil War. Now, who's going to answer for this? I mean, If I, as a private individual, were to do something, sell a product, for example, let's say something I got made in China, and it killed 100 people, this would be huge. I would be sued left and right. There would be criminal indictments and penalties against me. Or if I was a corporation and I made a product that I then unleashed, I made it in collaboration with some Chinese factories, I then unleash it in America and elsewhere, and it produces this massive death toll of, let's say, hundreds or even thousands of people. Wouldn't that corporation be shut down? Wouldn't its leaders and directors, the people who had knowledge of this, be under criminal indictment? Wouldn't they be facing massive penalties, massive fines? They would. So why is it that government agencies like the NIH are not vulnerable to similar scrutiny? Scrutiny, in other words, that's not just, hey, mistakes were made, let's just make sure that this doesn't happen again. No, let's ask who did it this time. Because after all those people who are now in graves were killed by what happened this time. Let's not worry for a moment about the next time, or to put it differently, we'll do better the next time if we figure out exactly what happened this time. Now, of course, it has been a principle of American government that if you make decisions, even very bad ones, you have immunity. There's a principle of immunity for decisions made by government officials. But I notice that the left is trying to get rid of that principle, at least in certain cases. What cases? The case of the police. The left is demanding, and in some cases, securing a modification of laws in which the police, who normally get immunity for what they do, that immunity is withdrawn. They're held criminally accountable. Think of Derek Chauvin, for example. He's criminally accountable because he put his knee on George Floyd's neck. Well, hasn't COVID put its knee on America's neck? Hasn't it put its knee on the neck of the world? Now, let's go behind the mask and look at Dr. Fauci's emails. More than 3,200 pages of correspondence, very eye-opening internal exchanges between Fauci and his staff, as well as Fauci communicating with other virologists. I want to focus on a couple of the telltale emails. Here's one. And this is coming from Dr. Ralph Baric. And Ralph Baric is a microbiologist at the University of North Carolina. He's actually been working with the Wuhan lab. He's in collaboration with the Chinese. And by the way, he's a good buddy of Dr. Fauci. So there's a direct connection, a kind of first name basis between Fauci and the very guys who are working with the Chinese. So when Fauci says, oh, no, there's really no direct connection with the Wuhan lab, that's really not true. That's really not true. Here's an email by a guy named Peter Daszak, another guy who is a major funder, by the way, of research, so-called function-enhancing research, making of these deadly viruses. And Peter Daszak is sending an email to Fauci, very telling. He goes, I just want to say a personal thank you on behalf of our staff and collaborators. Who were the collaborators? The Wuhan lab, for publicly standing up and stating that the scientific evidence supports a natural origin for COVID-19 from a bat to human spillover, not a lab release from the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And then he goes on to say a little later in the email, once the pandemic is over, I look forward to thanking you in person. So what is he thanking Fauci for? Not for telling the truth, because Fauci actually knows that in reality, and we see this from Fauci's internal communication with his staff, that he knows that this could have come out of the lab. But essentially, Peter Daszak, one of the collaborators with Wuhan, one of the funders of this sort of gain-of-function research, is praising Fauci for publicly lying. For saying basically, no, it's not from the lab. It's definitely coming out of a meat market. It has a natural, not a man-made origin. Now, how do we know that Fauci himself knew differently? Now we turn to an email from Fauci to his own deputy, Hugh Auchincloss. And this headline is headlined in all caps, important. It has a 2015 research paper describing this so-called gain-of-function research designed to make viruses more deadly. So Fauci knows about it. Why? Because he attaches the research to his own email. And here's what Fauci says. Hugh, it's essential we speak this AM, this morning. Read this paper. Auchincloss then writes back. He goes, the paper you sent me says the experiments were performed before the gain-of-function pause, but have since been reviewed and approved by the U.S. National Institutes of Health. So what Auchincloss is saying is that we once stopped this gain-of-function research, but we've started it up again. And so Fauci and his deputy are basically talking about the fact that they urgently need to speak because they have knowledge that this research is now going on and could have produced this catastrophic result. Now, we know some of what's been happening at the Chinese end, that this woman named Dr. Shi Zhengli, she's the so-called bat lady. She has been taking these deadly bats, these infected bats, extracting, if you will, deadly viruses from them, and then souping up the viruses, which is to say, making them even more contagious, even more lethal. And this has been going on, by the way, for years. It's been going on with America's knowledge, and it's also been going on with America's, you may say, collaboration, the similar research going on in American laboratories. So more work needs to be done to close these connections. Fauci clearly knew, but what was happening on the Chinese end? Did, in fact, and beyond a reasonable doubt, the virus come from the lab? That remains to be established. But if it can be established, and by the way, this is not going to happen in some random way. Let's hope the Chinese become more forthcoming. It's going to happen only through determined pressure and forced investigation. Forced investigation the way the cops do an investigation when there's a murder. In this case, think about it. There has been a mass murder. If murder even has a meaning. And by mass murder, what I mean is there have been massive casualties around the world. And if this was done either negligently or deliberately, then a crime has been committed on a global scale. It's hard to even think of a precedent for this. Somebody has to pay. Somebody has to answer for it. Somebody has to be held accountable. And we may as well start with the man who has presented himself as the kind of apostle of COVID, the savior of COVID, who, it may turn out, was also in part its perpetrator. We need a really serious investigation of how we got COVID-19. What do I mean by a really serious investigation? A determined and unrelenting, an unyielding, kind of maximalist pressure investigation? Well, I mean an investigation exactly like the one we're seeing right now over January 6th. Notice the prosecutors give no quarter. They go after the information and they go after facts and they try to make the indictment as crushing as possible. Why don't we apply some of that same sensibility? Why don't we, instead of having a January 6th commission, we largely know what happened in January 6th, how about a COVID-19 commission that operates with U.S. direction on an international scale to get to the bottom of this? Now, very interestingly, nobody seems to want to apply this kind of pressure, least of all one Dr. Fauci. He thinks that a more cooperative approach is appropriate. Listen.
I mean, it's obviously in China's interest to find out exactly what it is. And the is of the natural theory would be to find that link. So you have to keep looking for it. I mean, obviously you want openness and cooperation. One of the ways you can get it is don't be accusatory. Try to get both a forensic, a scientific, and an investigational approach. I think the accusatory part about it is only going to get them to pull back even more.
Now, first of all, let's start with the premise here. It is obviously in China's interest that the truth get out. No, wrong, false. If it was obviously in China's interest that the truth get out, the truth would be out. The opposite is true. It is obviously in China's interest that the truth not get out. Why? Because if this virus came from a lab, from the Wuhan lab, there really are two possibilities. One, it was released accidentally through negligence. But this is no ordinary negligence. Why? Because there have been 6 known previous leaks from China, all of which have contributed to SARS, to deadly viruses being unleashed in the past. This would be the 7th, the one on top of all the others. And so when negligence reaches such a level again and again and again, you begin to suspect possibility number 2, which is that this was done with knowledge, with foreknowledge, deliberately, perhaps even as a biological weapon. And if the weapon is deemed to be successful, namely, Trump is out, the U.S. economy takes a nosedive, the Chinese economy takes a hit but rapidly recovers and is now pushing ahead, the relative balance of power between China and the U.S. becomes more favorable to China, hey, that means it worked. That means you want to do it again. That means you don't want the truth of what happened to get out ever. So I find it really odd. And by the way, Fauci is not alone in this. You have also the collaboration of media and digital media. Here's a very interesting fact. One of Facebook's chief sources for its fact checkers in deciding who to ban on COVID-19 and on theories about the origin of COVID-19 is none other than Peter Daszak. Who's Peter Daszak? Peter Daszak is a major bankroller of coronavirus experiments at the Wuhan lab in the years leading up to the pandemic. Wow. A guy who has a direct self-interest in covering his own tracks, in moving any possible blame away from himself, in trying to show that, well, it wasn't me, it was a natural origin. A bat is responsible. Go and find the bat that started it and punish the bat. This guy is actually the source of the Facebook fact checkers. What an intellectual disgrace. And here's an article from Nature, a once respected science magazine. I'm reading you the title. Divisive COVID lab leak debate prompts dire warning from researchers. Well, what is this dire warning? The subtitle tells you. The allegations that COVID-19 escaped from a Chinese lab, quote, make it harder for nations to collaborate on ending the pandemic and fuel online bullying. What? Online bullying is now the problem, that people may actually be saying nasty things to the kinds of people who declared that legitimate theories about the origin of COVID-19 were debunked, were conspiracy theories. All these people are now caught with their pants down, and so people are making fun of them and calling them idiots because they are. So this online bullying now becomes the problem, and we don't want to have a real debate, and we don't want to get to the bottom of truth. Why? Because that may make international cooperation less likely. What kind of diversion and attempt to shift attention away from the crime is going on here? Don't focus on the crime. Don't try to figure out who the perpetrator was, because the perpetrator may be a little reluctant to cooperate with you in divulging what he did. This is basically the level of argument that we're dealing with here. I'm going to quote another line or two. They say that the people who are now talking about COVID coming out of a lab, quote, should have thought more about how it would feed into the divisive political environment surrounding the issue. So the problem isn't that we don't have the truth. The problem is that things are getting a little too divisive. So in the name of unity, we need to tamper down our investigation, not really get so heated about it, not really demand to know who did this, not demand any accountability, not ask why we've been lied to for 15 months. None of that. We should rather tamper down, settle down, and basically say, let's calmly approach the Chinese and seek international collaboration on a voluntary basis. That's what Fauci is getting at. He goes, don't antagonize the Chinese. They may clam up even further. Well, how much further can you clam up? When the World Health Organization researchers tried to get in there, the Chinese basically go, no. When the World Health Organization says, give us this information, they go, no. When they say, let's do testing of the people in the market and testing of the people in the lab to see who showed signs of COVID first, because that will help you realize whether it started in the market or started in the lab. The Chinese go, no. So no, no, and no. By and large, people who are the perpetrators of grand offenses that kill, in this case, millions of people, aren't all that eager to have the spotlight flashed upon them. So the issue here isn't Chinese collaboration. We're not likely to get very much of it unless there is unrelenting international pressure and unless the United States demands it. This is something that evidently the Biden administration is unwilling to do, and Fauci seems unwilling to think is even necessary. Next weekend, I'm going to be heading to Minnesota to join Mike Lindell on the stage at a big rally that he's having. This is a guy who really puts himself out. He takes a lot of risk. He speaks his mind. He speaks up for his faith, and he pays a high price for it. So I love to think about ways that we can support him that go beyond the normal. I've come up with a kind of new idea to encourage you to go all out on this with me. I call it the Dinesh Book and Movie Deal. Now, I haven't even mentioned it to Mike. So far, he knows nothing about it. Here's the deal. You go all out and buy $250 or $500 or $1,000 of MyPillow merchandise. It's really not hard to do. This guy, Mike Lindell, has more than 100 great products. His classic premium pillows, of course, but also the Giza Dream Sheets, the MyPillow Robes, the MyPillow Mattress Topper, the MyPillow Dog Beds, the list goes on. Now, here's the fun part. If you spend $250 or more, I'll send you a copy of one of my recent books, one of my favorites, maybe my most recent one, The United States of Socialism or The Big Lie, signed, autographed to you. If you spend $500, two signed books plus two movies, two of my movies. If you spend $1,000 or more, you get the special, you get four signed books and four movies, a kind of mini Dinesh collection. So let's show Mike what we can do for him and get some great books and movies in the bargain. Call 800-876-0227 or go to MyPillow.com. Now, to take advantage of this, you got to use promo code Dinesh. Now, what else do you have to do to get the books? Well, nothing. I'll get all the information from the MyPillow guys, and I'll send the books to the same address that you use for your merchandise. The offer ends July 4th. Again, that number to call, 800-876-0227, or go to MyPillow.com. Don't forget to use promo code D-I-N-E-S-H, Dinesh. A major Chinese state-run newspaper says China should get ready for a nuclear confrontation with the United States. At the same time that President Biden is saying that the greatest threat to America comes from white supremacy. I want to juxtapose these two facts and draw out their implications. Let's start with the first one. The China state-run paper, it's called the Global Times. This is a paper that is ostensibly somewhat independent of the Chinese Communist Party, but of course it operates with the full knowledge of the Chinese Communist Party. And the Chinese Communist Party likes to have a paper that can say things that aren't, quote, official, but kind of say what's on the mind of the communist leaders themselves. I want to quote from a recent editorial from this newspaper, Global Times. It says, given the intensifying U.S. Strategic containment of China, the author says, there are many urgent tasks, but quote, now, one of the most important is to keep rapidly increasing the number of nuclear warheads and strategic missiles like the Dongfeng 41 with extremely long range and high survival capabilities. What does that mean? Long range? It can hit international targets. We're not talking about short range or medium range, but long range missiles, what we used to call ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles. I'm going to continue now with the editorial. We must be prepared for a high intensity showdown between the US and China, at which point a large number of these DF-41, JL-2, and JL-3 will be the backbone of our strategic wills. The Chinese are counting their nuclear arsenal in the way that a guy in before a gunfight basically looks at how many bullets he has in his holster. Our nuclear missiles must be so numerous that the US elite will tremble at the thought of a military confrontation with China at that time. Now, it's not that they're advocating nuclear war, because they go on to say, China can then calmly and actively manage our differences with the US and avoid all kinds of gunfire. So basically what the Chinese are saying through this newspaper, Global Times, is let's be really strong so the US can't do anything. And if the US can't do anything, then we can do anything. Can do what? Well, we can take over Taiwan. We can establish our dominance over the South China Sea. We can bully all the other countries in Asia, from Australia to Japan to Korea to India. We can, in other words, be the mob bosses of our region. And the United States can just sit around. They can complain all they want, but there's nothing they can do. There's an old saying, by the way, what do you call a dictator who has nuclear weapons? And the answer is, sir. And the Chinese are applying that principle. We'll have a lot of nuclear weapons, and regardless of how upset the United States gets, what are they going to do? They're not going to risk a confrontation with us because we can incinerate many major American cities. So we're dealing here with China, and I think really for the first time doing this open kind of saber rattling and saying, look at what we got. Don't you dare try to question us. Under any ordinary time, this would be interpreted as something the United States should take very seriously. Instead, we have a doddering Joe Biden standing up and saying, I'm now going to quote him, terrorism from white supremacy is the most lethal threat to the homeland today. Not the Islamic radicals in the Middle East, not ISIS, not Al-Qaeda, not another 9/11, not an attack from China. White supremacy. Now, think of the craziness of this statement. Are white supremacists in this country running any major institution? Are they running any major corporation? Are there any white supremacist national political leaders you can think of? Can you think of a white supremacist cultural outlet, Hollywood studio, TV channel, or even influential newspaper or magazine? No. So there's a deranged syndrome going on here. Even, by the way, the Ku Klux Klan in its heyday, even if you go back to the 1920s or the teens, 100 years ago almost, the Ku Klux Klan, when it had 3 million members, didn't pose any kind of grave national security threat to the homeland in the way that foreign threats proved to be. Was the KKK a bigger threat to the homeland than, let's say, the Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor? Or Hitler declaring war on the United States and unleashing a major world war? What kind of American leader spouts such nonsense? I mean, white supremacy is now a spent force in America. It started declining right after World War II, and because of World War II. It was Hitler who discredited the idea of white supremacy, of Nordic supremacy, of racial superiority in general. And every survey from the World Values Survey to many others shows that racism began to rapidly plummet, starting in the late 1940s, because its consequences were so obvious. So at a time when the U.S. is endangered, not by January 6th protesters, not by the Capitol Hill walkthrough, not by white supremacy, but by powerful foreign agents, powers that are nuclear-tipped, very dangerous, not less dangerous than the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union had a lot of nuclear weapons, but the Soviet Union didn't have the kind of technological or economic power that China does. China is a more dangerous rival. Recognizing that is the first step to political wisdom. But unfortunately, we've got a guy in the White House, a feeble-minded buffoon, this hoary old crank, this unhinged fool, who, when there are threats looming abroad and nuclear weapons pointed at us from dangerous adversaries, all he can do is look around and say, "Where are the white supremacists? Where are the white supremacists?" That's the threat we face. How unsafe we feel with this guy in the Oval Office. You know what saved our lunch and dinners during the COVID lockdown? Omaha Steaks. Now, Debbie likes to have her cooking simple and easy. She enjoys cooking meals on the slow cooker. These Omaha Steak dinners are really delicious, and I say this as a foodie who's not all that easily convinced. I have so many favorites. Beef stroganoff, fully cooked pot roast, chicken and dumplings, jambalaya. This is making me hungry right now. As you know, summer is almost here, which means Father's Day is around the corner, and it's all about grilling. Go to omahasteaks.com, type Dinesh in the search bar, and order Dad the Get Out and Grill assortment. It includes 20 entrees he's guaranteed to love. Ultra-juicy burgers, plump chicken breasts, sides, desserts, and 4 10-ounce butcher's cut New York strips. These strips are aged 30 days. And why is that important? Because age equals tenderness. Plus, get 4 free New York strip burgers with your order. These are ultra lean and pack a bold, intense flavor. Omaha Steaks isn't just steak. It's the best steak of your life. Guaranteed. Visit omahasteaks.com. Keyword Dinesh and order the Get Out and Grill assortment today. Send Dad more than just a gift. Send him an experience he'll love and can share with you. And don't forget, for a limited time, get 4 free New York strip burgers with your order. That's omahasteaks.com. Keyword Dinesh. St. Louis attorney Mark McCluskey was propelled into the national spotlight when a group of Antifa, Black Lives Matter types came storming into his neighborhood. He and his wife, feeling threatened, went for their weapons, and they were seen on their front porch brandishing these guns. Now, the media portrayed this as some kind of scandal. Scandal not on the part of the invasion of the neighborhood, but on the part of the McCluskeys. And now Mark McCluskey is running for the Senate in Missouri. Mark, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining me. Let me start with that fateful day when all those guys came into your neighborhood. Describe why you felt threatened enough to want to go for your firearms.
Sure. Thanks for having me on the show. You know, given the enormously dangerous normal background violence in St. Louis, and then we added on top of it the George Floyd incident, where on June the 1st and June the 2nd of last year, the mob burned down downtown St. Louis, shot 4 police officers, killed a retired police captain and chief of the Moline Acres Police Department, David Dorn. And these were just random rioters who broke into the pawn shop where he was working secondary and killed him, live streamed it. And so this was a violent mob that had proven itself to be dangerous and deadly. And then on June the 28th of last year, in late afternoon, 300 to 500 of them broke through my gate and stormed into my neighborhood, which is all a private neighborhood. There's no public property here. The streets, the sidewalks, streetlights, everything are owned by us. Breaking through that gate was a moment when, at least from my perspective, that protest stopped being peaceful, and they were trespassers. And I had every expectation that they would do to me that which they had done to downtown St. Louis and Captain Dorn.
And when you were standing there on the porch, what was the sort of nature of the exchange between, if any, between you and those guys? Were they shouting threats or were they shouting slogans? What were they saying to you and your wife?
Well, the first thing that happened was as soon as they broke down the gate and came in, I stood out on the porch and I said those two most hateful white supremacist words known to the English language. I said private property. And since they're communists, when I said private property, it inflamed them. And they started rushing towards the house. My wife and daughter went in to call 911. I reached in and grabbed my AR-15. When I stepped out on the porch with a rifle, the chant was, "We're going to kill you. We're going to rape your wife. We're going to burn down your house. You've got a business. Your business is gone. That's going to be my bedroom. That's going to be where I have my breakfast. That's going to be where I take my shower after we kill you and take the house." And that was the nature of the nonviolent protest, along with the people wearing body armor and carrying weapons. When they did eventually get down to the mayor's house, they chased away a NBC affiliate with an AK-47 rifle. So that's how peaceful this protest was.
Mark, is it a fact that after all this happened, the attorney general charged you and your wife with offenses? What were the charges? I mean, it seems to me this is an outrageous assault upon your property and on your neighborhood. And all you did was respond to that by essentially attempting to protect your castle, if I can use that term. What would they possibly charge you with? And tell us a little bit about the prosecutor behind this.
Sure. And not the attorney general, because the attorney general of the state's a Republican. He's one of my adversaries in the Senate race. But it's our local circuit attorney. It's what we call our DA here. It's the circuit attorney. She's a George Soros-funded left-wing extremist. She views her job as the prosecuting attorney to be social revolution rather than prosecuting crime. She has this blacklist of officers who she considers racist, so she won't prosecute their arrests. They don't even know who they are. So if you go out and arrest somebody, you don't know if the prosecutor is going to take that arrest or not. When they do get around to trying something, they're so incompetent, they lose over 50% of the cases they try. But they charged us with flourishing a deadly weapon, right? We didn't put off a shot. We never left our own property. Every single, quote, protester, unquote, was standing on private property, and nine of them eventually got charged with trespass, and those charges were dropped instantly. My wife and I, on the other hand, are still facing 4 years in prison and the loss of our licenses and our livelihood for doing nothing more than defending ourselves against a mob which had proven time and time again to be very, very dangerous.
Mark, what about this? I mean, this very example that you give points to me to a larger double standard of justice. I mean, you've had these Antifa types, they burn St. John's Church in Washington. They've been assaulting Portland now for months. They set fire to the courthouse. They attack police officers. And I just contrast their fate with the January 6th protesters, because you have people who seem to have done somewhat similar things. I would say in the Antifa case, more violent, and yet the January 6th protesters are sitting in solitary confinement. They're facing this kind of maximalist approach to being charged with all kinds of imaginable offenses. Whereas the other guys are like catch and release. They're not prosecuted at all, or if they are, they're let off with very light sentences.
We even have the vice president of the United States, before she was vice president, funding the release of these mobsters from jail so they could get out and riot again the next day. It is such an upside down world. You know, the people sitting in solitary confinement now for months for doing no more than the people that broke into my neighborhood did, trespass. None of the people that broke into my neighborhood, threatened my life, have spent a day in jail. And yet there are, I think the last time I heard, something more than 36 people that have been in solitary confinement since January the 6th for doing no more than the same trespass and not breaking anything, unlike the people that broke into my neighborhood. So yeah, it's a totally upside down world.
Let's talk about running for the Senate. You've been a Republican. I assume you've been, I don't know how involved you were in politics before, either as an activist or as a donor, but something must have convinced you to sort of jump into this arena. Talk about that process. Talk about what your life was like before and what made you feel like now's the time for me to step up.
Well, you know, if you'd asked me that question a year ago today, I'd have said that what I wanted most in the world was for the world to leave me the heck alone. I'd had a nice, pleasant life. I've done pretty well for myself. But what I had no intention of doing was entering the public arena. But, you know, the world had another plan for me. And when those rioters broke into my neighborhood and then came back on July the 3rd with twice as many numbers and the specific intent to kill us and burn us out, we just made a commitment that there was something totally wrong with this world and that we needed to devote the rest of our lives to trying to fix it, to save our democracy. We had heard the president's speech at Mount Rushmore the day late on July the 4th, and he talked about combating Marxist extremism in this country. And the media portrayed that as a divisive speech. And my wife and I said, if combating Marxism in the United States is divisive, then there's something horribly wrong with our system, and we need to fix it if it takes us the rest of our lives. And so I've never been a politician before, but that's what caused me to make a commitment.
Mark, let me ask you this. You've talked in some of your comments that I've seen in the news about the fact that our country is so divided, and it is divided. But the rioters who came into your neighborhood weren't random thugs. This wasn't a case of people who just said, okay, well, let's just go on a spree. As you mentioned a moment ago, this is rioting that has friends in high places. There are powerful people in the media. There are powerful people in Hollywood. There are people in the Biden administration, maybe going all the way up to the vice president, if not the president himself. Of course, Joe Biden, who doesn't know a whole lot, but says that Antifa is just an idea, as if an idea came marching into your neighborhood. My question is, are we facing in this country a serious threat of something we haven't, at least not in my lifetime, seen, which is not just street violence, but street violence that is licensed with the approval of a major political party?
I give you an example. The lady standing outside my gate on the second assault on July 3rd, chanting into the megaphone, "You can't stop the revolution." That's Cori Bush. She's now the United States representative from the First District of Missouri. She's walking the halls of Congress. That woman who advocated the violent overthrow of our government had the gall to say on the floor of the House, "No one who supports insurrection should be allowed in the halls of Congress," referring to our Senator Josh Hawley. Yet she's the only person I know in the halls of Congress that has actively advocated violent revolution. The other person that organized that event, this was an event started by an entity called Expect Us St. Louis. The heads are Cori Bush and a woman and a guy named Rashid Aldridge, who's got elected to the Missouri legislature. So these are two people, communist revolutionaries, who are now elected officials, one to the United States government, one to our state government. And as I mentioned, we have the vice president of the United States who advocates for these revolutionaries. And we have Maxine Waters, who stands outside the courthouse in Minneapolis after a year of violence and murder and arson and looting, saying we have to be even more confrontational. These mobsters are like the brown shirts. They are the enforcement arm of the left. Do as we say, or we'll burn, we'll loot, and we'll kill. And that's what we're facing.
Wow. Very, very insightful. Thank you, Mark McCloskey, for joining me. Best of luck with the Senate race. I know it's a little bit of a crowded field, but I know you'll stand out, and all the best to you.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me on.
Did you know that in April alone, consumer prices spiked by 4.2%, the highest bump since 2008? Higher fuel prices, higher food prices, construction costs, housing prices. Inflation isn't just coming, it's here. Have you protected your savings, your investments? If you have not yet diversified a portion into precious metals, the answer is no. Now, for years, actually decades, I never invested in gold, just the stock market. But now I'm seriously worried about the regime we have in Washington. Absolutely no sense of fiscal responsibility. So listen, if all your investments are tied to greenbacks, you're sitting on a ticking time bomb. Invest a portion of your savings into gold and silver. Birch Gold Group is who I purchase from and who you can trust to convert an IRA or eligible 401k into an IRA backed by gold and silver. That's right, through a little-known tax loophole, you can convert your retirement savings tied to the stock market into an IRA backed by precious metals. It's your hedge against inflation. Text Dinesh to 484848 for your free information kit on precious metals IRAs or to speak with a Birch Gold representative today. With 10,000 customers, an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, and countless five-star reviews, Birch Gold can help you too. Text Dinesh to 484848 and invest in gold like I did before it's too late. The actress and singer Barbara Streisand is jumping into the political arena and striking out at Republicans. Now, Barbara Streisand, well, she's been one of Debbie's singing heroes. And in fact, there are people who say that Debbie sounds a little bit like her. And since my producer is in studio, maybe we can hear a line or two about this.
Memories like the corners of my mind.
Now, I got to tell you, that's the old Barbara Streisand.
Misty watercolor memories.
Now, that's not how Barbara Streisand sounds now. To figure out how she sounds now, you got to get the Dinesh version. Memories of a time when I could sing, but those times are long gone, so now I'm into BSing. Well, anyway, this is Streisand, who apparently says that Republicans want an authoritarian state. Why? I'm quoting her from a tweet. The GOP no longer believes in free and fair elections. That's why they're taking away the rights of voters. Now, let's pause here for a moment. How does saying that you can't vote, let's say, on Sunday morning take away the rights of voters? The saying that you require an ID take away the rights of voters? The saying that you can't collect other people's ballots and deliver them in your Volkswagen in the trunk of your car, is that taking away the rights of voters? No. Now, who does the Constitution assign the task of setting election laws? The answer? The states. Who's passing these laws that regulate how elections can and should be held? The states. They're acting in accordance with the Constitution. And by the way, the state legislatures who are passing these laws, they are democratically elected. These are people ultimately who have been given their authority to act by the people themselves. So where's the question of subverting democracy in any way? Very interestingly, Barbara Streisand uses this term, you know, authoritarian. It brings to my mind that while the right is accused of being authoritarian, Trump was accused, he's an authoritarian. What the left is doing right now in this country, and this is what they're trying to divert attention away from, they are actually acting in a manner that is not just authoritarian, it's totalitarian. Now, this distinction between authoritarianism on the one hand and totalitarianism on the other was developed almost a generation ago by none other than Gene Kirkpatrick. Remember Reagan's ambassador to the UN, Gene Kirkpatrick, also a professor of strategy at Georgetown. And in a famous article called Dictatorships and Double Standards, Gene Kirkpatrick contrasted authoritarian governments. A good example of an authoritarian government would have been Pinochet's Chile. So Pinochet wanted to be the ruler of Chile. And as a result of doing that, as a result of coming to power by military coup, ruling by force, Pinochet would limit the rights of Chileans. They couldn't, for example, do political protests against him. He would have them arrested. But by and large, said Jean Kirkpatrick in her analysis, the goal of an authoritarian and the goal of Pinochet is nothing more than to keep a hold of government power. That's what they care about. They don't actually care about running the ordinary lives of the people. They don't actually care about telling people what to eat or how to think or what religion to practice or who they can hang out with or what they can say at work, or what they learn in school. Pinochet was indifferent to all that. Why? Because his main goal was basically his own security in the palace. A totalitarian, on the other hand, says Gene Kirkpatrick, is driven not just by the personal desire to rule, but by an ideological desire to regulate, to even sometimes to minute detail, the lives of citizens, to basically keep them subjugated and under full surveillance and full control. Think of that's what the Soviet Union did. It regulated the ordinary lives of citizens. You want to go practice the Russian Orthodox faith? No, they'll shut down the Russian Orthodox Church. And that's what is happening in America, I'm very sorry to say today. Think of your right to free speech. Do you still have it? I would suggest that you don't. Your right to assemble. Do you still have it? Not entirely. your right to worship. Do you still have it? No, you don't. It's operating currently, right now, under very restricted conditions. Your right to self-defense. That's being questioned. There are talk about laws that would, in all kinds of ways, block your ability to defend yourself. Your right to raise your kids as you want. The left says no. Your right to bake a cake if you're the Colorado Christian baker. No. If you do it, they're going to force you to bake a cake and express views you don't want to express and articulate a set of beliefs that runs athwart or against your moral convictions. This is the very definition of totalitarianism. It comes out of the word total control of the lives of citizens. So Barbara Streisand, my message to you is don't worry too much about this fake, bogus authoritarianism. There's no authoritarianism coming from the right, but there is totalitarianism coming from your own side, which is to say from the left. That's what you need to worry about. That's what I need to worry about. That's what America needs to worry about. If you're thinking of replacing your carpets due to pet stains and odors, you must try Genesis 950. The reviews? Incredible. This is one product that actually works. Now, with water, it breaks down the bonds of stains and odors so they are gone for good. Its antibacterial component removes pet odors from carpet and padding. It can be used in a carpet cleaning machine, and it's green, so it's safe for your family and pets. Genesis 950 is made in America. 1 gallon of industrial strength Genesis 950 makes up to 7 gallons of cleaner. But Genesis 950 is also great for bathrooms, floors, upholstery, and grease stains. Debbie uses it to clean the entire kitchen. And when I got chocolate on my pants, oops, and on the couch, Genesis 950 took it right off. Genesis 950 has great customer service. Order 1 gallon direct at genesis950.com to receive a free spray bottle, free shipping, and a $10 coupon code using the code Dinesh. That's genesis950.com. Coupon only available for 1 gallon purchase. Try it. Genesis 950. It's much cheaper than replacing your carpets or your pants or your couch. Debbie and I were in Naples, Florida for a little getaway this past weekend. And I don't know if you noticed, but I might be a shade darker. That's because I've been walking in the sun on the beach. And I'm solidifying my credentials as a person of color. Sometimes that has to be made very obvious. And these getaways in the sun kind of help. In any event, I took some reading with me. Rather, this may seem like an odd book for me to take. It's called Contra Celsus. It's written by one of the early Christian writers, one of the church fathers, a guy named Origen, O-R-I-G-E-N. The title itself, Contra Celsus, is interesting. Celsus was a Roman writer who had written a powerful denunciation of Christianity. And we don't have Celsus's work. It's lost, as in fact are a number of classical works by ancient Greeks and Romans. But interestingly, we have Origen's answer to Celsus. That's why it's called Contra Celsus, sometimes called Contra Celsum, the Latin version. Origen is replying to Celsus, but in replying to Celsus, he actually has long quotations from Celsus, so he gives us an idea of what Celsus was saying. And therefore, he gives us a wonderful, revealing window into a debate that was going on in the early centuries after Christ between Jews and Christians and Romans. Now, what this shows us is that apologetics, the defense of Christianity, is a very early phenomenon. It's not something new that we do now because we're living in secular culture and we're dealing with atheists. No, the early Christians had to defend their beliefs against criticism coming from people from a different perspective. What's remarkable about Celsus is that he was, as a Roman, as the Romans were, the pre-Christian Romans, they were polytheists. So Celsus isn't really an atheist. Well, he's a little bit of a skeptic. It's not clear that he really believes in the Roman gods. The Roman gods, by the way, were pretty much the same as the Greek gods. The Romans just gave them Roman names. And a little word about ancient polytheism, because when we think of polytheism and multiple gods, these gods were believed to be immortal. but they were not believed to be omniscient. They didn't know everything. Nor were they omnipotent. They had tremendous power, and the power was sort of distributed. One guy, Poseidon, is the god of the sea, and Zeus is the god of thunder. But nevertheless, these gods are not all-powerful. And interestingly, they also don't live in some realm outside the universe. They live on Earth. The Greeks and Romans believed that there was a place somewhere on Earth, perhaps unidentified, but this was Mount Olympus, and this was the place, the realm in which the gods lived, and by the way, ate and also drank. Today, when we talk about apologetics and we meet atheists, the atheists are atheists against monotheism. In other words, they're atheists against the idea of the Jewish and Christian God, the one God who is all-powerful, who is omnipotent, and who is omniscient. Atheists today don't bother to fight against polytheism. They don't try to refute Zeus or Diana or Poseidon. They focus on the Jewish and the Christian God. Now, by looking at what Celsus is saying and how Origen answers him, we get a very revealing peek at early apologetics. Now, interestingly, Celsus, being a kind of polytheist, he doesn't get why the Jews and the Christians are arguing. He goes, wait a minute, you guys are kind of crazy. He goes, one group believes that the Messiah has already come. The other group believes in a Messiah, but he hasn't come. It's not this guy, it's some other guy. And to Celsus, this is like idiotic. It's like, it makes no sense. And you can see from the polytheist point of view, Celsus's own view is that each city should worship its own god. And he's puzzled by this idea of a single god over the whole universe because he thinks that the Egyptians should worship the Egyptian god. He's not against the Jews worshiping the Jewish god. And he's not even against the Jews believing themselves to be the chosen people because he thinks that, of course, the Jewish god chose the Jews in the same way that the Greek gods chose the Greeks, and the Lydian gods chose the Lydians, and the Persian gods chose the Persians, and so on. So this is how polytheism operated. And weirdly, Celsus accuses the Christians of being atheists. What? This may seem kind of crazy, but what Celsus is really getting at is he's saying, listen, if you belong to a city, and in this case, of course, we're talking about the early Roman Empire, and you don't worship the gods of the city, you are disloyal to the city. And since the gods are believed to protect that city, you are disloyal to those gods, and therefore you are an atheist. You're an atheist because you are claiming the protection of the city, you are benefiting from the protection of the gods of that city, but you refuse to believe in those gods. Now, it's really fun to see how Origen kind of takes on Celsus. Celsus says things like, Christianity is extremely unreasonable because all these Christians talk about is this concept of faith, a concept that seems incomprehensible to Celsus. But Origen goes, wait a minute, don't you have to have faith when you undertake any human venture that has an uncertain outcome? He says, what about when you go on a voyage? What about when you contract a marriage? Do you know in advance how that marriage is going to turn out? No, it's a leap of faith. He goes, what about when you become a father of children? He goes, do you know how they're going to turn out? No, it's a leap of faith. So basically, Origen says that when you expect good results, but you're not guaranteed to have them in all the ventures that we do in life, that's a leap of faith. So what are we as Christians are doing that is really all that different? A second thing that Origen does, which I think is very interesting, is he turns the tables on Celsus and he asks Celsus to give his reasons. And this is worth remembering today when we engage in apologetics, because the atheist will say something like, how do you know there's life after death? And one answer to that is, how do you know there's not? And this is kind of what Origen does. Celsus basically says it's ridiculous that these Christians believe that the earth had a beginning, that sort of in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And Celsus goes, well, where's the proof of that? And Origen goes, well, Celsus, you haven't explicitly said, but you appear to believe that the universe is eternal. Where's the proof of that? So what you have is Origen demanding of Celsus that he meet the same standard that Celsus is trying to impose on the Jews and on the Christians. So when we come back, I'm going to go delve a little further into Celsus's arguments against Christianity and the Christian thinker Origen's defense of it. Debbie and I have gotten to know Dr. Douglas Howard, who founded the company Balance of Nature. What a remarkable guy. He's a walking encyclopedia. He convinced us we're not eating enough fruits and veggies, even though we thought we were. Now, you don't need to eat the stuff you don't like. Turn to the Balance of Nature solution instead. Can you imagine how you'd feel if you were eating 10 servings of fruits and veggies every single day? Debbie started this first, as she often does with these things, and I'm doing it too. We take 6 daily capsules and we're set. Debbie loves how they smell. The fruit smells like fruit and the vegetables smell like vegetable. We get all our vital nutrients sourced from 31 fruits and veggies every day. Debbie also swears by the fiber and spice powder. She says she's never been more regular. Join us and experience the Balance of Nature difference for yourself. For a limited time, all new preferred customers get an additional 35% discount and free shipping on your first Balance of Nature order. Use discount code AMERICA. Call 800-246-8751. That's 800-246-8751. Or go to balanceofnature.com and use discount code AMERICA. I'm talking about the fascinating book written by the Christian writer Origen called Contra Celsus, in which the Christian Origen is refuting, challenging, the Roman polytheist Celsus about God and Christianity. Now, Celsus, as I mentioned a little earlier, says to Origen, or says in effect to the Christians, why don't you Christians respect the law of the city? Every city has its own God, and you are morally obliged and legally obliged to worship that God. And if you don't, you're sort of an atheist. Now, Origen replies, I think, in a very sophisticated way. And he basically says to Celsus, he goes, wait a minute, Celsus, there are always two types of law. There are the laws that are made by cities. Let's call those, what we call them today, the positive law. But then there is also, says Origen, the law, as he says, written on the hearts of men. Let's call this the moral law, or the natural law. And Origen says that that is the law that God has imprinted on our hearts. Now, even if you don't believe that, you still believe that there is such a thing as conscience. There is such a thing as that inner sense of right and wrong. And that doesn't always resemble what the city asks you to do. So, says Origen, as Christians, we follow the moral law. And we follow the law of the city to the extent that that law, the positive law, is congruent with or matches the moral law. But if there is a conflict between the positive law, the city's law, and God's law, we follow God's law. And here I think we see at the very beginning an articulation of the sort of philosophical basis for the natural law tradition in Christianity. Now, Celsus goes on to say, to print side by side passages from Plato and passages from the Bible. And Celsus basically says, look at the passages of Plato. The philosophers are so superior in their grandeur of tone than this kind of simple language in the Bible that is intended to appeal to kind of fools and idiots and women and children. This is the kind of aristocratic bias of Celsus. And Origen says, wait a minute. I agree that the Platonic language is more lofty, is more aristocratic, if you want to call it that. But, says Origen, which language makes people into better people? Who is actually improving the lives of citizens? What is the proof that Plato's laws or Plato's Republic has created moral reformation among the Greeks or among the Romans who embraced those ideas? There's very little evidence for that at all. Meanwhile, says Origen, we Christians, through our teachings, we're making all kinds of people in all walks of life act better, live better, do the right thing, so we can be judged, as the Bible itself says, by our fruits. And then says Celsus, moving on, he says, you know, this Jesus character of yours is a really weird guy. He's supposed to be God. And says Celsus, if he's God, then he actually has foreknowledge of what's going to happen to him. He knows that they're going to come to kill him. And so says Celsus, why doesn't he tell his apostles? Why doesn't he alert them in advance? Why doesn't he say, guys, there's a plot brewing. They're going to come get us. Let's make our escape. This is what any rational person would do. And Origen replies that because Jesus has foreknowledge, or because God has foreknowledge of an event, doesn't make him responsible for that event. See, Celsus is blaming Jesus for being a kind of accessory to the plot against him. He's saying since he knew about it, he's partly to blame for it because he could have escaped it. And therefore, by not doing that, Jesus himself brought on himself what happened to him. And so, an Origen, in response, is making a distinction between knowing about something and being the cause of it. In fact, Origen gives a beautiful example from Greek literature itself. He points to the tale of Oedipus, in which the oracle warns Laius and says, Laius, listen, you better not have any children, because if you do, your child will murder you. So that is a good example of the oracle having foreknowledge. The oracle is warning Laius not to have a kid, because that kid will kill you. But is the oracle causing it to happen? No. In fact, the oracle is sort of trying to prevent it by telling Laius, don't have a kid. But Laius goes on and has a kid, Oedipus. And this produces, of course, the tragic events. And so Origen's point is that knowing about something, it's kind of like if I'm standing on the top story of a building, I can see a car that's moving towards someone about to hit them. But nevertheless, I may be powerless to prevent it. I'm too high up to even issue a warning. I know what's going to happen. I have foreknowledge of the event. But no, I didn't cause the event. So this is just a flavor of the kind of argumentation that we get in this sort of early Christian apologetic. I'll just give one more brief example. Celsus is talking about God, and he's reading about God in the Old Testament and then the New Testament. And Celsus goes, what is all this silliness? God is sleepy. God is angry. God is impatient. God is jealous. And Celsus goes, this God of yours sounds like some petty guy who has essentially human vices. And now in a very important point, Origen responds and says, no. He says, it is true that the Bible uses that language about God, but the Bible is speaking, you might say, in an accommodation to human understanding. The Bible is using human language, almost like Disney. You know, a Disney story uses human emotions. The animals being shown don't act like real cats and dogs. They act like people who are in cat outfits or dog outfits. Similarly, God is described as having these human emotions in order for us to be able to sort of get a sense of what's going on. So let's say, for example, if humans commit grave sin and God is described as angry, it doesn't mean God is angry in the human sense. God isn't like ticked off the way we humans would be ticked off. Rather, God upholds the standard of perfect justice. So if we were God in that situation, we humans would be annoyed. We'd be annoyed because justice is being violated, because our creatures, the creatures we made, are turning against us and betraying our will and rebelling against us. So as humans, we would respond in a human way. God doesn't respond in exactly that way. So God is being described, says Origen, really by analogy, so we can get some understanding of what an infinite being might be like. Bottom, at the end of the day, my two trademark phrases, the bottom line at the end of the day, I kind of go back and forth between them. What you have with this book, for me fascinating, is a very intelligent early Christian making insightful, perceptive, and in some cases enduringly important arguments against an early critic of Christianity. I mentioned a little bit earlier the Dinesh MyPillow incentive program, which is to say that by spending $250 plus or $500 or $1,000, you get signed books and movies. It's a great deal. Now, Christmas is coming. It's not right here, but it's not that far away. So here's my idea. My pillow, my slippers for everybody this year. great idea. Mike Lindell has taken over 2 years to develop these amazing, this is his newest product. They're designed to wear indoor, outdoor, all day long. They're made with the special MyPillow foam and impact gel to help prevent fatigue. They're made with quality leather suede. And for a limited time, Mike is offering 40% off these new My Slippers. The My Slippers are so comfortable, you're going to get one for yourself and one for your spouse and one for the whole family and also for gifts. We actually did exactly that. Now, here's Danielle, my daughter, with her moccasins. And, of course, Debbie and I just love ours. I got the moccasins. She got the slip-ons. And we're getting gifts in advance. Now, go to MyPillow.com. And to get the discount, you got to use promo code Dinesh. By the way, deep discounts on all the MyPillow products, the Giza Dream bed sheets, the MyPillow mattress topper, and MyPillow towel sets. Call 800-876-0227 to place your order, or just go to MyPillow.com. Make sure you use promo code Dinesh. Okay, guys, it's time for our mailbox. By the way, if you want to send a question, preferably audio or video, send it to questiondinesh@gmail.com. Let's go to today's question. Listen.
Hi, Dinesh and Debbie. My sister Vera and I love your show on Rumble. I've been reading The Founder's Bible, The Origin of the Dream of Freedom, and I was wondering if you could give us a historical overview of the Bible, and which Bible do you read? Thank you.
Well, I might just have to focus on the second part of your question, which is my favorite Bible. Now, there are, of course, a lot of great Bibles. If you're Catholic, the Catholic Revised Standard Version is awesome. My favorite Bible is the King James Version. In fact, we just got a new one. Our old Bible, Debbie and mine, was kind of marked up. So this is the KJV, King James Version Study Bible. And it's just beautiful. Debbie's going to put a link to it on the site so you can look for it yourself. By the way, the King James Bible was produced by a committee. This is kind of unbelievable because by and large, they say that a camel is a horse designed by a committee. Committees normally don't produce anything, certainly not anything important in the terms of a literary or spiritual work. But in the case of the King James Bible, you have a Bible that is just stands out, I think, in its sublime simplicity and just sheer beauty. I'm just going to read the first couple of lines from Genesis 1 to give a feeling of the kind of greatness of the prose of the King James Version. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. I mean, this is the mode and the tone of the King James Bible. It's the one that I use as my standard reference. Now, there are more popular versions today that kind of simplify the language, make it a little bit less antique. But for me, the King James Bible speaks in a tone appropriate to the great events being described in the Bible.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify, or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com.